Well, here we are for part two of our conversation with Joseph Goldstein and our plunge into the river of the Logos. And remembering at the deepest part of emptiness, we find, wait for this, compassion. Welcome to Deep Transformation, Self, Society, Spirit, life enhancing, paradigm rattling conversations with cutting edge thinkers, contemplatives, and activists, with Dr. Roger Walsh and John Dupuy. Join us in the evolutionary fast lane as we take a deep dive into transformational practice, peak experience, profound understanding, powerful contribution.
Going back to the paper and your summation, and I'm sure I'm paraphrasing this, but I would just like you to comment on the mystery. It just seems a mystery to me, is that once you do this work and through whatever agencies that you get rid of these defilements and these toxins and these cravings and these negative aspects that we've been able to create so well as human beings, that instead of just existential emptiness and voidness and nothingness and bye-bye, compassion arises. Greater compassion and your ability to transmit and do good in the service of others, other beings, increases. So what does that say about the deepest nature of reality? I find it awesome and deeply, deeply hope-giving and inspiring. So what is that mystery, and how do you account for that?
So I was sitting a two-month Dzogchen retreat. This was kind of my first introduction to Tibetan Dzogchen practice with a really great Dzogchen master, Nyoshul Ken Rinpoche. And he was giving a talk on bodhicitta. And somehow...
Joseph, could you just say what bodhicitta is? Because maybe
So bodhicitta is a central piece of Mahayana and Tibetan practice in particular. It can be described in different ways. In the most general way, bodhicitta refers to that aspiration to become awakened for the benefit of all, right? So it's not just for ourselves. There is another, you might call it a little more technical definition of bodhicitta, where they describe it on two levels, relative bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. Relative bodhicitta is compassion. Ultimate bodhicitta is the experience of emptiness. And in one of the teachings, it said, if these two are present, enlightenment is unavoidable. You know. Okay, so I'm sitting this retreat. Rinpoche is giving this talk on bodhicitta. And it was really one of the most really transforming moments just in listening, where I realized through his teaching that compassion is the manifestation of emptiness. And I want to kind of just talk a little bit about compassion, because even though that's the term that's used a lot, you know, and it's tremendous value, a word that I find more, I feel a broader term to define that quality is responsiveness. So it takes it out of the realm only of being a particular feeling, although that is one of the aspects. You know, we can have a feeling of compassion, but for me, compassion is much bigger than a feeling. It's just that innate capacity of responding to situations. So, for example, you're walking down the street and, you know, or you meet somebody that's hungry, you feed them. And it can be a totally spontaneous move. It doesn't necessarily have to be go through any particular emotional quality, although that may be there. But the key to that responsiveness is the key to the responsiveness on the most basic level is really the understanding of selflessness. Because to the degree that we're empty of self, so then the responsiveness happens so organically. because there's no self-protection or self, I don't know, whatever the self would be doing in those situations. And so a phrase that I really like is, compassion is the activity of emptiness. Yeah, there was another way of expressing it, but it's not coming to mind at the moment. So this ties in for me in a really personal way. And it has to do with the Bodhisattva vow. Yeah, and that's not really a part of the Theravada teachings mostly, although it's there, but it's not kind of highlighted. But I had come across, you know, those teachings and very inspiring. It's like, that's a beautiful thing to aspire to. But part of my mind always thought, it's a beautiful idea, but this is impossible. How am I going to save all beings? Yeah, it seemed like a nice idea. And I didn't really see the nitty gritty way of developing it. But then when I had this understanding of bodhicitta, that this responsiveness or compassion is the activity of emptiness, all of a sudden I understood the bodhisattva vow in a completely different way. Because at first, and where I had been somewhat doubtful about my own ability, you know, in that sphere, because it was all resting on the shoulders of a self. You know, when I started thinking, oh, how can I take on this bodhisattva vow to save all beings? Resting on the shoulders of a self, it just seemed completely impossible. But when I understood responsiveness or compassionate responsiveness as the activity of selflessness, of emptiness, then it takes the me, the I, completely out of the picture. And so then it's just going through the world. Just a little sidebar here. The expression for me of what expresses the Bodhisattva vow, it was the title of a book, Paul Gorman and Ram Dass back in the 70s. The title of the book was, How Can I Help? And I love that title. And I've used it. It's become part of me. So that's, to me, that's the frame that can just describe the spontaneous responsiveness, that quality. And Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche had a beautiful expression of this. Bit of a paraphrase, but this is the gist. He said, when we realize the empty nature of phenomena, and we could say empty, selfless nature of phenomena, the energy to bring about the good of others dawns uncontrived and effortless. And I think that's just so beautiful that we take ourselves out of the way, and then that's the natural manifestation of emptiness of self is compassionate responsiveness.
You're not responding, but you're being responded. In other words, you're not thinking, I'm going to fix this.
Yeah. And the more open we are and the less self-referential, the more easily that happens.
Maybe we can do another round here, Joseph. Yeah. I'll point out what you've said and you'll point out that what could be said better. So three things come to mind in relation to that. One is the bodhisattvic expression, this expression of the commitment to the desire to awaken and hone oneself as an instrument of service and well-being and awakening for others. Alan Watts had a beautiful line which said, a person at this stage trusts their nature, which is nature itself, to do that which is called for.
Would you send me that quote? That expresses beautifully what I was trying to say.
And then another couple of stories. The sense of the bodhisattva aspiration, which is unfortunately often phrased as a bodhisattva vow, not I would love out of the depths of my being to become an optimal instrument of service for the welfare and awakening of all, but rather I vow to liberate all beings, which to me is very unskillful phrasing.
Yeah.
But in one of the earliest retreats, and I think we may have been on one together of the Dzogchen that Lama Suryadas did with a traditional Tibetan Buddhist teacher, every sitting began with, you know, we're going to do a bodhisattva vow. After about a week or so, I stood up and said, you know, it took me 9 years to make a vow to serve one being, my wife, let alone all beings. He was not impressed. And a third thing I want to introduce is that there's a very important talk you gave early on when you just come back from Burma practicing some of the loving kindness and compassion practices. And you said, usually I had thought, and I think a lot of us think of the desire to help and compassion as coming out of some aversion to suffering, some, ugh, got to get rid of this. And much of it does. But you had a line, you said, there is no aversion in compassion. And I remember I was so struck by, I came up to you afterwards, you'd given the finished talk and said, are you sure there's no aversion? And your response was wonderful. You said, why don't you try the practice? And you were right.
Yeah. Well, to build on that a little bit.
Please.
So, you know, at least in the Theravada framework, maybe there's something equivalent in Tibetan as well. But each of those Brahmaviharas of metta and compassion and, you know, empathetic joy and equanimity have what are called the near enemies. You know, it's a mind state which kind of looks like it, but actually is not it and unskillful. Yeah. So it's just an example. The near enemy of loving kindness is attachment. You know, the near enemy of compassion, and this was really interesting to me, is sorrow. And the point was that in sorrow, there is aversion. But in compassion, there isn't. And this became very real for me when I was doing sort of intensive compassion practice. And the way at least one starts is you think of a being who's in tremendous suffering, right? Because that's what will elicit, you know, that response. So you imagine you hold that image in your mind, and it's a very simple phrase. It's just the repetition of a single phrase. May you be free of suffering. May you be free of suffering. And because you're connected, you know, with this being that is really in very obvious suffering, it really calls forth that wish or that, you know, may you be free of suffering. So doing this, like for weeks at a time, it was just so noticeable that even though the object or the image which was used as the foundation for suffering, for compassion. So even though it was a situation of suffering, but in doing the compassion practice, it did not lead to sorrow. And it's even hard to describe what word, but maybe we could call it open-heartedness or something like that. You know, yes. It's that feeling of connection and an uplifting wish. So that's...
Well, I said, is sorrow something of the gateway to get to where you're talking about, to that place of deep compassion that is no longer overwhelmed? And you said in your story about the zero, you look at the zero and you see nothing. You look through the zero and you see the universe. So I'm wondering if the zero in this case might be sorrow itself, and going through that is you get to real compassion and something, you know.
Well, I think it would depend on how one is relating to the sorrow, because a lot of people, and in a way it's understandable. So I'm just commenting on, you know, some common experiences, but often, especially in situations of intense suffering, it's easy to kind of get lost in the sorrow, you know, or drown in the sorrow. And then that becomes the field out of which one is trying to operate. But if, you know, this kind of awareness of this whole process, and, you know, we might immediately, the first response might be sorrow. But then if we understand the nature of the mind and these different mind states, then we transfigure it and we move from the sorrow to a compassionate response of how can I help?
Yes.
You know, and in that moment, it's not sorrow anymore. It's like an uplifting energy in the face of suffering. How can I help? Rather than, oh, this is so terrible. What can I do? Energetically, it's completely different. But for many people, and myself as well, as you say, maybe that first initial response is of sorrow, but then it's what we do with that.
Yeah. That was very personal. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I like your phrase, the uplift. It's an uplift. Compassion is uplifting. And yeah. I remember when I finally took your advice and actually did a retreat specifically focused on compassion and loving kindness, that literally within a few hours of the practice, this thought arose, I've spent my entire life misunderstanding compassion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very different.
I think one of the aspects, and this is what happens so often, I mean, in a wide range of experiences, but it's the move from some degree of selfing to non-self, you know? And so when we're just lost in sorrow, there really can be a lot of selfing in that, a lot of I. And in that, what, you know, that description of compassion as being uplifting responsiveness, that really comes out of selflessness. It's not a self doing it. It's just that natural responsiveness, as Dilgo Khyentse said, you know, when we realize emptiness, the energy to bring about the good of others dawns uncontrived and effortless. And I love that. It's just that spontaneous responsiveness. And that's the phrase, for me, it kind of captures it better even than compassion, which is a beautiful word. And, you know.
And spontaneous responsiveness is exactly the phrase which is used in Tibetan Buddhism for this.
That's where I got it from.
Okay, well, that would explain it. You know, one of the repeated emphases here, Joseph, and not surprisingly, both from your own experience and from the tradition, is on the emphasis of seeing in direct experience that what we take to be a distinct self, a controller, an observer, an operator, decider, etc., is actually something added by the mind. It's a mental construction. And you also said that, you know, in an interview which you did recently, discussing a recent long retreat, that you'd had a still deeper insight into this and recognized a more subtle level of this. And I wonder if we might talk a little bit about these different levels of seeing. And I have a particular context or frame here. I recently began studying with an interesting approach by a man, Kevin Chenillac, who created the program working specifically with the 10 fetters. And a very interesting program. It's like, oh, people after 2,500 years are still coming up with new approaches, new ways in. Beginners in a stage with it, but I have found it helpful. And one of the distinctions he draws is between the belief, the presupposition of a self per se, and a subtler experience, a presupposition of a subjectivity, not a self per se, but just subjectivity, objectivity. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Do we have a few hours? Okay, so two things come to mind. Since you mentioned the framework of the fetters or defilements?
Yeah, 10 fetters, yeah.
10 fetters, right. So,
maybe you could just explain a little about.
Yeah. So in classical, at least in Theravada, there's probably some equivalents, you know, in the other traditions. These are the unwholesome states of mind or patterns that keep us bound, you know, to samsara, keep us from being free. And so the first few fetters are this belief or view of self. Belief, the second one is belief that certain rites and rituals will free the mind, which the Buddha, and especially in the Buddha's time, there was a lot of belief in that. These days, I think that's less of a problem. And then the third fetter is doubt, just doubt about the path and the practice, the teachings. And at that first stage of enlightenment, these first three fetters are uprooted. Then there is desire and aversion. The next two fetters, they are only attenuated at the second stage of enlightenment and uprooted at the third. And then the last five has to do with attachment to different of the higher realms. So there are two fetters connected to that. And then restlessness, conceit, and ignorance. So those three, plus the attachment to the heaven worlds, they're not uprooted until full enlightenment. So this leads to a very interesting situation, because the view of self, the belief in self, has been uprooted at that first stage called stream entry. And yet conceit in the Buddhist sense refers to any manifestation of I am-ing, right? I am relative to another person. I'm better than, I'm worse than, I'm the same as, or I am-ing over time. I was this in the past, I am this now, I will be in the future. So you can see that I am all centers around the I. So the question quite reasonably arises, well, if that sense of self has been uprooted at the first stage, why is there still the I am-ing until we're fully enlightened? But this becomes really clear in practice. So at that first stage, because we've experienced, it's what I call the experience of the zero center, which could be another way of the experience of emptiness, the experience of nibbana, but it's that experience which, after which we realize that there is no self-center, that the center of this whole process is the zero center. So we know unmistakably that self is a construct because we've gone beyond it in our experience. However, there are still very deeply conditioned habit patterns of mind, one of which is this habit pattern of conceit, of I am. So as a habit pattern of mind, that's still there. But after the belief in self has been uprooted, we understand that pattern of I am as itself being selfless. It's just another impersonal habit pattern with the particular content of I am-ing. But we no longer take that to imply that there is a self, because that view has been liberated. So it's just an example of, even after we have gone beyond the view of self, deep habit patterns are still there. And that's what I think Chenul meant. Sudden realization is that uprooting of the sense of self, and then the need for gradual cultivation, because the habit patterns are so deeply conditioned.
And it's partly accepting the I am-ing, but not giving it very much energy, realizing it's just the leftovers from whatever that was.
Exactly. So I'll just share a little anecdote with you about this. This happened, I think it was just last year or the year before. You may be familiar with the monk Bhikkhu Anālaya, German monk. He's a high power yogi. he's impressive. So he lives just down the road at the study center in his cottage. And we were both doing a self-retreat at the same time. So he was down in his cottage, I was doing my house. And it was I think he may have even been on a year retreat. I don't remember. I was doing a 3-month retreat. And then somewhere in the middle of the retreat, I was just frittering away sometime. I don't remember what I was doing. But then the thought came to me, I'll bet Analio's not frittering away any time. and just that thought, I began to get a little down on myself. you know, a little self-judgmental. Yeah. I mean, he's the real thing. And what am I doing messing around here? But thanks, I think, to many years of practice, it didn't take long. It took, I don't know, maybe I was in that kind of self-judgmental, emotional place, I don't know, for 10 minutes or so. And then I realized, oh, that's just the Pali word for conceit is mana, M-A-N-A. I said, oh, that's just mana. It's just that pattern of comparing. As soon as I recognized it as being mana, the whole thing disappeared. The thought disappeared, all that emotional reaction to it disappeared, because it was just seeing clearly the impersonal nature, the non-self nature of mana itself. So having the clarity, and this is a point which I've just come to appreciate more and more recently, kind of appreciating the liberating power of recognizing the particular defilement that is creating the particular thought content, whatever it may be. You know, so in this case, the thought content was, oh, I'll bet Analia's not wasting his time, you know. And as long as I was staying on that content level, I could get more easily caught up in it. Because it was true. He probably wasn't wasting his time, you know. But as soon as I dropped from the level of the content of the thoughts to recognizing the defilement which was generating the thought, oh, that's just mana. It was in the recognition of the defilement, becoming mindful of it, that the whole thing evaporated.
And you were able to take that and use it in a noble way to refocus on your path, your work.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And but in a way, you know, we started this conversation where you were asking me about the forward edge of practice. It's things like this. You know, sometimes it's just simple things where we find ourselves in a situation of suffering. And if we don't waste our suffering, but rather investigate it, you know, it's when I was looking, oh, why am I so caught in this? Oh, that's just mana. That's conceit. So it's all these little things that actually are the forward edge of our practice.
So it's, you're suggesting, first off, that the edge is always our current experience, what's arising in our current experience, and that the edge keeps presenting itself in each moment. We're never short of an edge if we bring awareness, mindfulness to it.
Yeah. Yes.
If we don't, it's a trap,
yes.
Illusion.
And the edge does not depend on being on retreat, although a lot of these things reveal themselves on retreat, and I'm a great lover of it. But I've had really interesting edge-like experiences just in the world and in things that are happening. You know, when we pay attention to our mind and we feel like we're caught in some suffering, just in our worldly lives, that's the edge for us, and that can be a place of really deep practice. So as much as I love retreat time and continue, you know, to practice in that way, I think it's a mistake to limit our sense of exploration, you know, or deepening to the retreat format, because it's all life, you know, and a life takes different forms, but it's the same mind-body process. And so we can be learning, you know, profound things, not only on retreat, but
moment by moment. And certainly that's one of the things I've taken away from your teaching is I remember you saying a number of times, continuity is the secret of success in this practice.
Let me write that. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. And just a moment ago, you were talking about the power of recognizing a problematic pattern and being able to name it. And there's something very important in that general principle, that it helps to have, it can help depending on how we relate, to have a map and to know what the traps and openings are. And that sometimes if we're not too lost in it, simply the recognition of what's going on, and particularly the naming of it, is enough to release.
Yeah. So just this point that you're making.
Good, please.
Kind of opens up to me a really interesting dimension of the practice and an understanding of what mindfulness is and isn't. So on one side, so in the Buddhist psychology, which you're very familiar with, mindfulness and perception are two different mental factors. They're two different qualities. And perception, at least in one of its main meanings, is that of recognition. You know, and that's where concepts come from. We perceive something and we put a concept on it. We recognize what it is. Oh, it's this. This is a tree, not a car. So that's perception. So on the one side, this is all part of the Buddhist psychology, when it talks about what are the conditions, the supportive conditions for mindfulness to arise, one of the conditions is perception. Clear perception allows us to be mindful of what it is. So it's kind of like putting a frame around a picture. You know, we put the frame of a concept around an experience, and it enables us then to focus on the experience itself with mindfulness. So in one way, perception and recognition is a support for mindfulness. But on the other side, and this, I think this is really important for people who are practicing, to understand that not to conflate recognition and mindfulness, which people often do. And I did that in a big way in one particular situation where I thought that because I was recognizing what was there, that I was being mindful of it. But so I'll condense a very long story, but I was working with fear. And this was a big, for a number of years in my practice, it was something that just kept coming up a lot. And I recognized, I knew it was fear, and I was noting fear and all of that, but it still felt very lodged in me. And then at a certain point, something shifted in my mind. This is after years of working with it. And the thought came, if this fear is here for the rest of my life, it's okay.
Mm.
And that was actually the first moment of acceptance. Because even when there was recognition, it was through the filter of wanting to get rid of it.
Yes.
And so it was through the filter of aversion, which I did not understand, because I thought that the recognition itself was being mindful. And so I wasn't seeing the aversion. As soon as I came to that place of acceptance, which is characteristic of mindfulness, it's amazing, the whole thing washed through. And it doesn't mean that fear never comes up again, but the whole relationship to it has changed, all based on being mindfully accepting. Oh, okay, this is just another passing emotion. So this understanding of recognition and mindfulness and not conflating the two, even as we understand that a clear recognition is a support for mindfulness, mm-hmm. it's weaving those two understandings together.
And this is going to be a unique experience of me trying to get you to be more precise. But after having a lifetime of you and training me in this, but would you say that could one say that you were mindful of the fear, but not mindful of the aversion to it?
I would not say that.
You wouldn't? Okay.
No, because as long as the aversion was there, that if the aversion is there, I don't see that as being mindful of the fear. It feels like the mind, it was like looking at the mindfulness through a lens.
Yes.
Kind of an aversive lens. And this, I have a feeling, just reflecting a little bit about this point, I just have a feeling that this very point has probably been argued about a lot. of whether you can be mindful through the aversion, you know, mm-hmm. of what or not. But in my experience anyway, it just felt completely different when that filter was on. And it felt because there was just a lot. It was sort of like the block, you know. When I was framing it in terms of a block, there was not being mindful. So in this, with the aversion, I think that was what was feeding the aversion was an embedded sense of, oh, I'm such a fearful person. There was kind of an I somewhere embedded in it that was feeding the aversion and wanting to get rid of it. Whereas in the moment of acceptance, that sense of I was gone. It was no longer I'm afraid. It was just fear is another arising state. So it's in that way that I think I question whether, you know, there's real mindfulness there when it's this aversion fed by some I sense just doesn't feel ultimate.
I have one more thing I can't get away without asking it. That's okay. The idea of refuge. And when I hear that in the Buddhist sense, I think of interior peace. And I don't know if that's, you know, right on or not, but the idea of seeking refuge in the Sangha, in the Buddha, and in the Dharma, that's extremely appealing to me because I'm a good sufferer. You know, I'm really good at, you know.
We all are.
Yeah. But is that something that can be there and present during your whole journey? Although you might be just a little baby, you know, starting to meditate, starting to work on mindfulness, can that refuge that's provided in the transmission of the thousands of years of these people that have been pushing this ahead or going with it, something that we can, dare I say, desire or hope for or experience on the path?
Stay tuned for part 3 of our conversation with Buddhist master Joseph Goldstein. Thank you very much for being a part of this conversation. We hope that you were moved as we are moved being part of it ourselves. We'd also like to say that this is being funded by Roger and myself. It comes out of our pockets. So if you would like to help us to mainly to get this podcast out to more people, because the bigger audience have, which is steadily growing, but the more people we can reach and the more marketing we can do, the more positive effect we can have on the world. So we've done a couple of ways, but we'd like you to buy us a cup of coffee. Very simple. And I do that with podcasts that I support, and I find it's very satisfying. So thank you for your help. Thank you for your presence, and thank you for all you are and all you do. We love you.